Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today has had many careers, from newspaper editor to high-tech marketer. For 6 years, he was known for his radio column and podcast, The Urban Man, as heard on affiliates of NPR. And as a book reviewer, he was one of the founders of the Bay Area Book Awards. I'm talking, of course, of Mark Porter Zasada. His new book is The Impossible Shore, a story cycle of 14 closely related stories. Mark reads segments from a couple of stories in his book today. He'll also share insights into his inspirations, challenges, and thoughts on storytelling. The book again is The Impossible Shore. My guest, Mark Porter Zasada. Mark Porter Zasada, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Vicki.
Well, it's a pleasure, and we don't very often get books of short stories, so I'm especially pleased to talk to you today. Some interesting things to talk about. But first of all, I want to talk about your background, because you had such an interesting career, a long list of experiences, and I'm thinking you were maybe ahead of the curve, because today it's quite common for people to have a long list of what I do behind their names, including myself. But back then it was a little bit different. But you've been a newspaper editor, high-tech marketing exec, theater and classical music reviewer, book editor, radio essayist at NPR, the list goes on. Favorite gig and why?
Well, for 6 years, I was the urban man on KCRW LA, the NPR station down here in Los Angeles. So that was certainly my favorite gig. But I had great fun being a high-tech marketing executive, too. I worked with Microsoft for years. And the corporate life and the literary life, tried to combine that.
Okay. Well, we have a little crossover there, because I, too, have spent over a decade as a consultant with Microsoft as a communication strategist. So
there you go.
Interesting.
Built,
yeah. And so you just mentioned that you were known as the urban man, and I watched a video this morning, actually, on YouTube. It was from about a decade ago. It was called Just One Little Thought, and I thought this was really interesting. And let's get your perspective on this, because when you did that, you know, 10 years ago or whenever, and the whole premise of that was, can we even have an original thought of our own today? And I was thinking it's got even worse since then, because we're constantly bombarded with the noise of technology. So I think that piece that you did, Just One Little Thought, is even more true today. How do you see that fits in as, you know, this, we're always on in this selfie lifestyle of today?
Yeah, I think that piece already feels dated, because everyone has now accepted the idea that they're bombarded with information every second of their lives, looking at their phones and so on. And the idea of kind of having an extended meditative original thought about life, universe, and everything is a bit gone by the wayside. Everyone is reacting now. But we just accept that.
Yeah.
We just accept that as normal now. And in some ways, this book is an attempt to get past that. In fact, there's one story in there about a rock star who goes into a coma, and during the coma, people play him radio programs and music and everything, and he can't stop it from happening. He has to deal with that as a kind of hell while he's out of it. And I actually do try to deal with that somewhat in the book.
Right, right. All right, so let's talk about the book, The Impossible Shore. It's a story cycle of 14 closely linked tales, a diverse range of characters and perspectives. So let's begin with the title, The Impossible Shore, and what that means to you. Did you start with the title, or did it come to you as you were writing?
The title came pretty late after some struggle, but once I thought of it, that was it. the impossible shore refers to that sense that all of us have, that there's something great and infinite just beyond our reach, that maybe we could get there if we just tried a little harder. And in the book, all the characters have visions or a sense of that, which I think humans have always had.
Yes.
Not you. But people dealing with that in the modern context and seeing it just out of reach, just at the edge of the vision, the impossible shore.
Yeah, it's a great, great title. So I want to look at the prologue. There's a quote I read a long time ago, and it's, from time to time, it's really haunted me. It's by Catherine Ann Porter. I don't know if she's a relative of yours because you have Porter in your name too, but she was a journalist. She was born in 1890. And her quote was, "The past is never where you think you left it." And I share that because it kind of leads into or parallels to some extent the prologue that you write about, and there's a section you're going to read to us from the prologue. I wonder if I can ask you to do that.
I will do that. We do not leave the past to move into the future. It's more like past and future stand ever side by side, fighting and embracing like lovers. We are the child caught unhappily between, fighting sometimes with the one parent and sometimes with the other, torn as they pull us back and forth with terrifying violence, moment to moment, hour to hour. Day by day, century by century, the past cries out to the future. Do not set aside my beauty, my desires, and my carefully constructed truths, even as you try to take my precious child to some impossible shore.
Well, I think that sets up things beautifully. I read that you said, you know, your whole goal was to explore the way in which we don't so move through much through time as become different people in different times. And more importantly, to understand how each person's longing for the infinite, however personally defined, pulls us relentlessly forward. So I think this sets it up beautifully. Why did you feel it was important to do that?
Well, for one thing, the stories take place often over a long period in people's lives, which is kind of unusual for short stories. They're not kind of like focused moments in a day, but they actually sometimes cover someone from youth to age all in one short story. But at the same time, there's these critical, seemingly random moments that propel people, that change their lives profoundly. In one story, it's just a bird flying by a window that casts a shadow across a desk that changes a woman's life forever. And in another, it's a cell phone that doesn't get answered, and so on. But I think that we all feel that constant struggle between what happened yesterday and what's happening tomorrow. Like, it's never resolved, and they're always kind of fighting against each other.
Yeah, and often we think it is resolved, and then the slightest little thing will upturn it again, and you're like, why am I thinking about this 20 years later?
Sure, there's moments that I remember every week from the past, and often it's why. Why do I remember those moments? Well, I guess they represented something to me, some change in my consciousness. So this book does explore that. One thing I want to point out is that I'm hoping it's not seen as a book of short stories, but as a story cycle, which people read like a novel, because kind of one story answers the other, and issues that are introduced in one story are resolved in another, and so on.
Right.
So I hope people read it in order and see it in that way.
Right. It definitely flows. And so, as a writer, did you outline your stories before you began this to make it, you know, fit this way deliberately?
No. Although it came to that ultimately, but here's a little secret, is that three of the stories were actually first drafted when I was 25 years old, and I'm now 64. So they sat in a shoebox for all that time until I think I was ready to finish them and create the rest of the book. So everything flowed from those three stories, which I'm not going to identify, But that was the genesis of the book, and it came together into this greater meaning over time.
Well, I love that, Mark, because we're told as writers never throw anything out, even if you think it's terrible. You know, Neil Simon had Brighton memoirs sitting in his drawer, garbage drawer, for like 10 years before he pulled that out. So, and I've spoken with many people who've said the same thing, you know, it's about timing, it's about pacing, and all of a sudden, you know, the story is right. So I love that story. One of my favorite stories in the book, and I don't know why, you know, things just resonate with you, right? Is the story of the Bright Forest, which is about two young people, Gregory and Sylvie, who meet and fall in love. And the Bright Forest is a metaphor for Gregory's life with Sylvie. And I was really drawn into that, and maybe because I once lived in a similar Bright Forest, who knows? You know. But I wonder if you'd share some thoughts around that story and what sparked the concept and why it was important to include it in the cycle.
Well, I think anyone who's ever fallen in love knows that love is kind of a separate world that you create with another person. There's a true sense when you're with that person and truly in love that you leave the normal world behind, and you exist in that state. And that has its upsides and its downsides as a mode of life. And I think everyone senses that. And we all struggle with kind of what's inside and what's outside the relationship, inside and outside that world. Actually, if you'd like, I could read a little passage from that.
I would love that.
He was, of course, about to discover the deepest extents of the Bright Forest, a world where anything might become beautiful. In the Bright Forest were green bottles and mossy curbsides, wet iron railings, bits of colored paper caught in the trees, a world like a fine photograph. He could see roads leading to dilapidated gas stations, sudden rocky overhangs, rows of maple, the gathering places of strangers. In the Bright Forest, no one read newspapers on trains. They ran their fingers across the cold window panes, drawing circles. Later, at the station, people did not speak of schedules. They huddled against each other on benches and whispered. Each object in the natural world was but a marker for a potent force in the Bright Forest. Each work along its paths, a work of God's. In the distance, somewhere was a lazy conductor beating a slow baton. Now you will sleep, now you will make love. They would listen and lie together on long afternoons, would lose jobs for lying together on long afternoons. That's it.
I'm so glad you read that passage, because I had actually marked that up in my book. It just was so visual to me, and it just hit the nail on the head. How did those characters come to you?
Well, I guess one lives life and one falls in love. And maybe that's all I'll say.
Okay. I'm not going to say which story, but there's another story where there's a line, and I'm not going to give away spoilers here, but there's a line where you write that a character knew. He just knew that, like most men, he would never be happy. I'm hoping that's purely fiction and not what you really believe. Tell us about that.
Well, that story, which, you're doing a spoiler there, is about the concept of trying to find enough and searching for more, and it plays with those ideas very directly and dramatically in this person's life, and I think that the character comes to an understanding that the path that he chose, or that kind of chose him, would never lead to happiness. Now, whether he's right about other men not finding happiness in the world, well, that's his opinion, not necessarily mine as an author.
I want to just jump into what it takes to write short stories, because it's very different from writing long form novel. I didn't see that you have a novel out there, Mark. I know you've done a lot of writing over the years, but storytelling is definitely what you do. And there's definitely a different approach to writing short stories than there is long form or screenplays. Tell us what kind of elements to you make a good story and what you're looking for when you begin writing that story.
Well, I think, you know, as a process of writing, I just do a lot of random writing and ideas until it starts to come together. But ultimately, a short story has to be, I hate to say it, about the ending. Unlike a novel, which can have many turns and twists, and there's novels that you read that you're very satisfied with, even though you never actually read the ending. Not like that. A short story, to me, encompasses a single idea, a single image, a single concept, which it's almost like an argument. Now, I'm not sure that that's the modern view of a short story. It might be a more old-fashioned view of a short story.
Right.
You mentioned Katherine Ann Porter. But but to me, that's what it means. And my stories are, in my mind, as much essays as they are stories. They do explore an idea. In that sense, they may also be a little old-fashioned. But to me, a short story is very much a specific art form, very different than a novel.
Right, right. Well, throughout the book and in your writing, storytelling in general, you write of relationships, divorce, happiness, music, art, religion, different philosophies, points of view, and how the world is organized depending on how you live in it. Are there subjects that are off limits to you as a writer?
Huh, that's an interesting question. I hope not. I don't think so. I tried to write exactly what I thought and without kind of worrying about other people's opinions in this book. In fact, I toward that point, maybe I could read a little passage from the book, the story called Fiction. This is a story that is highly literary but has a certain erotic element. But let me just read this from the first paragraph. Sex is rapidly becoming the only poetry able to stand up to the prose of the present day. In a world dominated by 8-lane freeways, 5-acre Walmarts, 1,000-foot container ships, million-square-foot data centers, 2 million follower blogs, employee management software, old age homes, Part A and B Medicare, transmission towers disguised as palm trees, 24/7 news, 24/7 fast food, and the 24/7 chatter of millions and millions, what else can really help us stay human? We will have to depend on fragrant limbs and stroked thighs for our birth. Everything that used to serve, be it clouds or waterfalls, sailboats or hyacinths, loss or religion, just doesn't seem sufficient anymore. That's why the same people who used to say, start with love and be patient in waiting for sex, now say, start with sex and be patient in waiting for love.
Why did you choose that particular passage?
Well, I suppose because you challenged me, was I willing to
You know, there are some things that some writers are uncomfortable writing about and don't touch, but I want to go back to how the world is organized. That's a constant theme throughout the book, and especially depending on your place in it and how you show up in the world, you know, exploring different points of view. And I'm wondering why that appeals to you so much, why you enjoy it's certainly fascinating to read, and you write about it beautifully, but why does that appeal to you so much?
Well, I think, you know, I've, as you mentioned, had a lot of different careers and lived some unusual parts of my life. I mean, something I didn't mention in my biography is I spent a year as the executive director of a synagogue in Los Angeles, among other things. And I think that what, by the time you get to my age, you kind of see that people live in very different sort of rooms throughout their lives, and when they're inside that room, they're kind of one person, and they see the world in a certain way, and sometimes they forget that if they walk down the passageway, there would be another room with other people in it, seeing the world in a very different way.
Hmm.
And that there's actually one particular story that explores that kind of deeply. The idea of painted rooms, that the rooms are painted kind of to fool us, but also kind of in a necessary way so that we can live our lives in a certain context. So it's not a bad thing that this is true. I don't think any of us could survive if we didn't live within a certain context in a certain painted room. But we always have to remember that down the hall there's another room, and that the room that we're living in can be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And often is, by something that happens, whether it's a divorce or loss of a job, or, you know, in one story about Native Americans in California in the 1900s by the arrival of the Spanish. And I guess that part of the purpose of this book is to help everyone see that, to both value the room that they're in and realize that there are other rooms down the hall.
Yes, it certainly makes you think. And, you know, you do cover different cultures in perspectives here. In The Dignity of War, for example, the character Mafaz,
uh-huh.
He ponders perhaps a man must be poor before he really sees how the world is organized. Only when he is poor does he have no protections against the truth.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's very true. Part of, I think, having money is that you are able to put up walls against certain reality.
Mm.
And anyone who's ever, you know, done both poverty and wealth can tell you that. So that character, you know, his life falls apart when there's a certain general that he's attached to goes out of power. And then it gets put back together again, maybe in not the best way. But he learns to cope with that. And I think his experience makes him more human. He learns to balance one thing against another.
Yeah, and it's definitely interesting looking at different people's perspectives, especially from a cultural perspective, too. Poetry is mentioned in many of your stories. Do you write poetry yourself? What's the interest in poetry, and how do you think it informs us?
I have written a lot of poetry, very little of it published. And in fact, there's a good deal of poetry in this book. In particular, there's a verse. There's a songwriter, story about a songwriter who writes a lyric. And in fact, that lyric is going to be made into a song to be released soon by an artist. And
comes out this in July, right? Comes out in July.
Yeah,
came out in July.
Yeah. Hopefully soon. People can find it on my website, impossibleshore.com, which I have to plug here. And hopefully that will be out soon. We're making it into a music video for the debut, and that's taking a bit longer than I'd hoped. But it's a great song.
Yeah, and, well, I look forward to hearing that.
I will send you a link.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We'll put it on our site. Do you have a favorite story? I hate asking that question, but I always want to ask it. Usually the answer is no, I don't. It's like asking me to choose between my children. But
exactly right.
You must have a like slight leaning toward one.
Well, probably people's favorite story, I hate to do this, is the one called The Productions of Time, which is about the rock musician that I just mentioned.
Mm.
People who read the book say, oh, that was my favorite story. Although the other one you mentioned, called The Dignity of Man, which is set in Pakistan, actually I spent quite a bit of time in Pakistan in the 1980s when that was set, might be my favorite, because of the meditative sense in that character's mind that I just resonate with.
Right. What was the most challenging part of putting these stories together, this story cycle?
I think the most challenging part was finding the harmony between the stories and ordering them in a way that it progressed in a novel-like way, because I did not start out with that intention, but it evolved over time. And the book, in fact, divides into three parts: visions, loves, and afterlives. And I think that that's sort of a progression of life also, that we all have visions that carry us forward, for better or worse. We all experience loves, not just of other people, but loves of work and country and God, and that kind of drive part of our lives. And then afterlives, which in this book, there are a lot of second chances that people get. There's a story called One More Second Chance. That's kind of the theme of the whole last part of the book, is second chances, both for the living and the dead.
God knows we all need those. Right? We all need second chances.
We all need second chances.
Mark, do you have another section you'd like to read to us? And we're coming to the end of our chat here. It goes by very quickly, but I'd love if you have another piece to read to our listeners.
I do. Let me, on page 218 there, if you have your book, it's a passage about the infinite. And everyone in this story kind of drives toward the infinite, which in many ways is symbolized by the ocean in this book. There's an ocean on the cover. And in this story, a character who we met much earlier in an earlier story ends up in Australia, drifting around trying to become a sailor. And he's a young man, and he's walking along the seashore, and he's thinking about the infinite. Here goes. Here's the thing about the infinite, toward which Noah has been moving since his story began, toward which all our characters seem to be moving. At the same time we fear the infinite, we find ourselves drawn toward it. We are as small children standing on the edge of an empty street, daring one another to run onto the vast asphalt. Some children do run into the street, but even the bold know they can handle its enormity only in limited doses. Like Noah, go and climb on the black rocks of the seashore, where the coastal creatures live. Notice how the barnacles and urchins, mussels and lichen, crabs and gulls and sea lions await the sea to bathe them, threaten them, encourage them, and feed them, all while they cling to their black rock homes. These creatures love the sea for its infinity, for its never-ceasing newness, for the way the surge washes everything to them and washes everything away again. Some swim far out each day. The gulls range great distances. But before long, they want to return safely home. Why? Because they rightly fear the sea, as well as love it. Probably they even hate the sea, because even as it feeds them, they know it might at any moment tear them away from the shore. And someday, of course, it will.
Beautiful. Well, the book is called The Impossible Shore, and my guest, Mark Porter Zasada. Final thought, Mark, you'd like to leave our listeners with. I know they can find out much more about you at impossibleshore.com.
I guess the idea of this book is that we all have a sense of greatness just out of reach, as if we all have some mission that we can't quite grasp. And I try to explore that in both its terror and its beauty in this book, and I hope people resonate with that and read it and learn something in reading it from my own thinking.
Well, it certainly stopped me in my tracks in a couple of places and made me think about things differently. And I think, you know, that's what good writing does. And it's written beautifully. It paints a beautiful picture. So I thank you so much for being with us, Mark.
Well, thank you, Vicky. That was really fun.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.